The new novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, takes place at an elite university writing program. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is the author of that book, and she also happens to be the director of an elite university writing program. Lan Samantha Chang is the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Her new novel follows a cohort of students through an MFA program in poetry. Roman is driven and ambitious. Bernard pursues poetry as if it's a religious calling. And Lucy is gifted but willing to be distracted from her writing by other things in life. In the next hour, we'll talk about the novel, writing, teaching writing, and of course the Writer's Workshop as well. We'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 866-780-9100 or send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join us after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Lan Samantha Chang. Her new novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, hits bookstores today. This is her third book. Her first two books, Hunger and Inheritance, were very well received. And in 2008, she was awarded the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. She lives in Iowa City, where she also is the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Samantha, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
And I was wondering if you could start with reading the first few paragraphs of your book to set the stage for us so we can all start on page one, so to speak. And your novel does take place at an MFA program, and this sets the scene for us.
Miranda Sturgis was an exceptional poet. Among the school's distinguished faculty, she was the brightest star, and graduate students fought to gain admission to her seminars. It was 1986, and the most fervent feared they had missed the age of poetry, that they were born into the era of its decline. To Miranda and the school, they came in defiance of that decline, or at least to sit for 2 years in the circle of her radiance. They yearned to know her mind and hoped to earn her blessing as they set forth on an uncertain path. But Miranda was critical of their work and dismissive of their hopes. She rarely offered praise. She discussed their poems ruthlessly, as if they were not in the room. Of the students in her classes, almost none escaped unaltered or unscathed, and some stopped writing altogether. Such was her teaching that the students at the school had invented a special nickname for her critiques. They were called bludgeonings, as in, he's drunk, he's just been bludgeoned. Out in the world, the small, passionate world of poetry, Miranda maintained a sterling reputation as a teacher. There was learning and acuity in her body of work, the shimmering debut, the rigorous and ambitious second book, the third book shortlisted for several major national prizes. She was considered an accurate and influential judge of talent. It was rumored that she sometimes took a special interest in the career of a young poet, and that her protégés began with a vital advantage. And so, despite the bludgeonings, despite confusion and hurt feelings, the students kept lining up to take her classes. They concealed their discouragement from their families, most of whom did not read poetry, from the school, of whose faculty she was by no means the worst instructor, and from Miranda herself, because they sensed, with the visceral knowledge of neglected children, that if they were to complain to her, she would not notice. Instead, they watched her keenly. They studied how she dressed and how she did her hair. They puzzled over the hesitant yet determined way she gestured as she spoke. They tried to copy these habits, as if they could learn to be Miranda, could transform their own young hands, grasping their pens, into her delicate, reluctant hands.
Your novel follows the lives and careers of a number of the young poets who go through this program with Miranda Sturgis. And let's talk a little bit about these different characters. Roman is the central character in the novel, and he's very driven.
Yeah, I think that Roman's drivenness is one of his central qualities. All of the poets in this book are driven, but Roman is driven in a particular way. He's driven toward the world. And I think that this is one of the reasons he ultimately becomes a success, but I think it's also one of his biggest struggles and challenges is that he's so ambitious. Roman is the kind of person who really wants to achieve. He wants external signs of his success. And it's very difficult to earn that kind of thing when what you're working on is so unquantifiable, something like poetry. And so Roman's always anxious.
And he's very methodical in
yes.
his path to success. He keeps very good records of all of the submissions that he's made. He makes submissions to journals on a regular basis. He's applying for fellowships. And he talks a little bit about strategy.
Right. He says, everybody says that only talent matters in this business, but strategy must matter. And certainly a combination of strategy and talent would improve the situation. So that's his take on it.
And he has an ally and a friend in Bernard who also doesn't fit in quite with the other students, although he's very different from Roman. And Bernard's a little bit older than the other students.
Right. Bernard's 31 when the story starts. And a lot of the students are much, you know, significantly younger. They're in graduate school, but some of them came straight from their undergrad studies. Roman is also a little older, but Bernard has an edge on everyone in terms of his big picture. He's thinking about literature in the big picture. He sees it as a calling. He sees himself as one part in a, you know, long, ageless conversation.
And he's willing to never achieve any kind of financial success.
I think, first of all, none of the poets I know write poetry because what they want the most of all is financial success.
Right, or you wouldn't be a poet.
That's right. Poets look beyond financial success. So when they're talking about achieving, each poet has, as far as I can tell, because I am not a poet, each poet has a different way of thinking about what achievement might mean. And most of the poets I know think in terms of art. They want to make art. And that's where Bernard is.
Right.
Bernard eschews, I mean, not in a hostile way, but he just disregards all of the stuff that Roman holds so dear. And the reason they're friends is that they're both so serious about poetry.
Bernard, you mentioned it's almost like a religious calling for him. And he does. He leads a religious life. It's almost a monastic lifestyle where he lives in a very, you know, the cheapest apartment he can find. He lives in New York City because that's where he wants to be to, I guess, be a part of the artistic scene. But he's not really. He lives in this little apartment and he spends all of the years of the novel working on one poem.
Right. I should say this novel, it begins in an MFA program. But after the beginning section, it moves past that and it spreads out over about 25 years. So really after graduation, Bernard sort of decides that he's going to pursue this dream he always had, which was to live in New York. And he takes a tiny, tiny rent-controlled apartment and he stays in this apartment, works in a coffee shop, and basically doesn't really go very far from his apartment, doesn't leave New York very often, and works on a long poem, which is entitled All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. And this is a poem that he began writing when he was in graduate school and actually put up in his seminar and had it critiqued by Miranda, who was bored by it at the time, who yawns, I think.
And her comment written on it, I thought was beautiful. Her comment was,
Yes, that's what she wrote on Bernard's poem. And that's how he knows that she even read the poem, is that there's the word written on the last page. But Bernard doesn't need external validation to continue working. He keeps working on this one poem, which is a long book-length poem for the length of the novel.
There are other people in the seminar. Lucy is in the seminar. She becomes more important later in the story. But describe this other group. And these are the people that Roman has lumped them all together and he calls them acolytes.
Right. Roman sees the people in the class as Miranda's acolytes, particularly the women in the class. Lucy is apart from that because she's actually friends with Roman and Bernard when they're in school. But he's contemptuous of the women in the class. And the reason is that he had an ill-fated romance with one of the women very early after he began the program and broke up with her. And now all of her friends, you know, naturally think he's a narcissistic jerk and hate him. And now the story starts with him stuck in a class with mostly these people, and he is contemptuous of them and they of him.
Tell me a little bit about the character of Miranda Sturgis, because we do, as the novel goes on, we do get to know her better. We get to go beyond that very cool facade that she has. But tell me how you see her.
How I see Miranda. I see Miranda as a poet. I mean, a true poet who, and this is probably my romanticizing the idea of what a poet is. I feel that Miranda wants to live a life where she's truthful as often as possible. And so in class, she's truthful, even if it means that she's critical and harsh. And outside of class, I think she thinks of herself as living, you know, an artistic life. And she has a husband who is in another city because she has an academic job. And so she commutes. And she has her work, which is of utmost importance to her, and consumes her and interests her. And then she has her teaching. And I think that Miranda's big mistake in the book is that at a certain point, she actually lets her feelings get in the way of what the truth is. And she ends up paying the consequences for this. I don't want to explain exactly how.
The description of Miranda, she seems like someone who wants to give very little of herself to others, which is not how things wind up for her. But it seems as if she's built a world around herself where she doesn't have to give personally.
I think that's probably true. I didn't think about it when I was writing it, but a lot of writers I know have worlds, similar worlds. It's very difficult to maintain and sort of create work out of a rich inner life if you are very busy in your outer life. And I think that Miranda has set up a life that's entirely tranquil and largely solitary, even though she has a partner. She says at one point, or Roman hears that she told some of the other students that marriage in its everyday practice is exhausting. And that's why she doesn't feel so bad about not being in the same city as her husband. And I think that the problem, of course, is that you think you have life set up the way that it'll work for you, and then it backfires. Something will backfire, I think. And I also don't think it's possible to live an artistic life without also having great excesses of feeling. So that even if you're trying to control the amount to which you're in the world, there's a certain part of most artists that is deeply engaged, you know, in an inner world that can affect the outer.
My guest today is Lan Samantha Chang. She's the author, most recently, of All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, a novel that is released today. She's also the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is Lan Samantha Chang. Her new novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, is being released today. She's also the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. And we've been talking a little bit about the novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, which takes place at the beginning at an MFA program at a university, a placeless university in many ways, but a very prestigious MFA program. And later on, one of the characters is also working at another fairly prestigious MFA program in the Midwest. This is a world that you inhabit. Now, of course, you focus on fiction, not on poetry, so that's a little bit different from the world that you inhabit. But why did you decide to write about something that's so close to your life?
Well, this book came as a surprise to me. I certainly didn't decide to do this. In fact, I had my two viable projects that were about my typical subject matter, which up until now has been Asian American families, somewhat downtrodden or haunted, you know, in struggling with their heritage and their lives in the United States. And I had actually written 100 pages. I was going to write three novellas about a family living in the Midwest, which is where I grew up. And let's see, the sequence of events was something like this. In January 2006, I began a job as director of the program here at Iowa, of the workshop. And this is where I had gone as a student from 1991 to 93. And I've also been here as a teacher. So it's a place I knew, but I'd never seen it from the point of view of being a director before. And that summer, I went to France to visit for 2 weeks. My husband was at a painting school in rural France, and it was very quiet, and I didn't have to worry about anything. And I guess it was maybe the morning I got there, I opened my computer and started writing, and I wrote 50 pages over the next 2 weeks, which is extremely, you know, a lot of writing for me.
It's for anyone,
about
these I would
people.
Think, but yeah.
Bernard Roman, who had a different name at the time, was the first person to show up. But Bernard showed up pretty much on the first day of writing, and I was very happy to see him because I was sort of sitting inside Roman's malcontent and anxiety. And I was like, oh, good, another character. And then Miranda, of course, was there. It was a classroom scene. And I just became completely interested in these people. I don't really know how it happened. And very rarely in my life have I felt that I've been given a gift, you know, some project that just comes out of nowhere and makes me happy. But this is the gift. I wrote the 50 pages, put the project aside. The 50 pages had basically some scenes from part one, part of a sketch between Roman and Lucy in part two, and then the final scene between Roman and Bernard in part three. So it was like the whole arc of the book kind of tumbled into my head. And then I had a really strong sense of what I would need to complete the book, but I wasn't entirely sure. And so I put it aside. And then 2 years went by and I didn't touch it. And there's several reasons for this. One is that I had a very demanding job. And also I felt that this project was esoteric and controversial. And that's problematic. I'd never written anything that was problematic that way. The story isn't about writing programs, but it takes place. It begins in a program setting. And I assumed that a lot of readers wouldn't be able to see beyond their own opinion about writing programs, opinions about the setting.
Well, and assuming that the portrait that you create of a writing program is emblematic of your personal experience. I mean, there must have been some concern.
It's not.
Right, but there must have been some concern about that.
No, I really wasn't thinking about that. I mean, let's see. I mean, first of all, I set the story in 1986, which is before I came. And, you know, things have changed a lot in the last, say, I don't know, 25 years. Things are much more strict. You know, at the time when this story takes place, they're smoking in the classroom. Smoking in the classroom was banned at our university in the early 90s, and I assume that was part of a nationwide trend. They were smoking, they were drinking in the classroom. That, you know, really didn't happen very often in my experience when I was a student here, occasionally. But what else was very strange about it? Well, the harshness, the extreme harshness of the discussion in class. You know, I don't think that most teachers teach that way anymore. But there was a period in the history of this kind of program when people really did. And I think that my experience in the program was, of course, very much influenced by my experience as a student in the classrooms of Frank Conroy, Marilyn Robinson, and James Allen McPherson, and Margot Livesey. And nothing, you know, there's nothing that really sort of even comes close in the book. However, it did feel to me that it would be strange, just strange to write a novel that was set in a setting very similar, you know, with similar dynamics. I tried so hard to make it different. When I realized that this was a viable project, which didn't happen for years, which I would explain, I I thought, oh, this is weird. You know, maybe you can, you know, try to make it clear that this isn't based on personal experience. But I think everyone just assumes it, just in the same way that a lot of people assume that I'm advocating for the workshop experience, and I'm certainly not. But I actually don't think that writers can choose what it is that they're going to write about. And my experience with this book is proof of that for me. I, as I said, didn't touch it for 2 years because it didn't seem like a viable project to me. And I assumed that no one would be interested in reading about these, you know, people. And the work felt very private. I felt that my other work would probably be more socially acceptable. And I had another set of changes that took place that have to do with life outside of the writing life, which is one, I had a new responsibility as the program director. And two, I was married, I didn't get married until I was almost 40. Three, I had a wonderful experience. My husband and I had a daughter in 2007, and she was the perfect academic baby. She was born at the beginning of June in 2007, and we spent the summer taking care of her at home. And at some point during that summer, I realized that there was no way that I could do all of these things at the same time. So I had four things. I had a marriage, I had a job, I had my daughter and writing. And I thought, wow, I can't do these four things at once right now. So I applied for a Guggenheim Fellowship. And I applied for the fellowship with a project called All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. This was not the project that is currently the book. It was the project about an Asian American woman who's married with a child who decides she's going to learn how to drive and takes driving lessons. And it's about her whole family. And there were going to be three novellas, one from the point of view of each of the characters. And it's a set of characters that I visited in my first book, Hunger, in the story, The Unforgetting. So I was just continuing to develop those people. And, you know, I was pretty sure that it would be a nice thing to work on. And I got the fellowship. And because my job in the spring is so work intensive with admissions, I decided to take off two fall semesters. So the first fall semester, I get started on my project and I get really, really, I run into this sort of resistance that you'd see in a teenager, you know, where you're telling them to do their homework and they're sitting there sort of like with their lip thrust out, staring into space or listening to music.
This was your internal struggle?
This is exactly how I felt. I had no desire to write that project. And it went on for about a month. And then I was panicking because here's the deal. When you have a family and a full-time job and you're always aware that other people have needs, there's something really – writing can feel really desperate and illicit. And it can also – I don't know – it brings on a sense of guilt because every hour that you're working, you're denying the needs of other people. And I tried, you know, a month wasted of this fellowship felt extremely bad. My husband finally said, look, why don't you just work on your poets project for 1 month and then put it aside? But at least you'll get a plan to work on it for a month and you'll get some gratification. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. So I sat down and I worked for a month. And, during that time, I set up part two when Bernard comes to visit, and I wrote this long flashback between Roman and Miranda. And I just wanted to do one more month, so I did one more month, and I wrote the scene in the parking garage between Roman and Bernard that I'm going to read in a few minutes. And the project felt like a guilty secret. It was my unofficial project. I was supposed to be working on the other project, and it just went on and on. And after about 4 or 5 months of doing this, I'd finished a draft and I thought, okay, now I've got this completely useless, like extremely short, you know, very unpopular project. And I thought I would just let it sit for a couple of years or whatever I needed to do and work on other things. But I showed it to a friend and who lives in town actually. And she said, actually, this is, you know, a viable project. This is pretty good. So I showed it to an old teacher of mine from when I was in the workshop, and she thought it was also a viable project. So I moved forward and finished it, which didn't take very long. I mean, the project came to me as if it were on fire, and it was such a pleasure to write. And it was really, really a huge pleasure for me. And I think that probably I'll get punished for that as it comes out, and everyone, you know, wants to know, like, who's this character and who's that character? And, you know, I guess I deserve it. I also have terrible karma, so I deserve it, because as director of the workshop, like last year, I signed 2,000 rejection letters, and I think the karma is going to come back.
Well, that's not personal. That's not.
Well, sure, but it is for some people,
right? Yeah, absolutely. The you mention your experience becoming a mother, and that's something that comes up in the book in a couple of different ways.
Yeah,
Miranda, the director or the head of this poet seminar that is in the beginning of the book, she has chosen not to become a mother because, well, you tell me why. Why did she choose not to become a mother?
I just think she didn't become a mother. She didn't either. I mean, in my mind, the way I think of it, I think that Miranda's work was so consuming to her that she didn't feel the need to. I don't think people should have to. I mean, I didn't have my child until I was 42, and my life before that was very full. Now that I have a child, I can't imagine what my life would have been like if I hadn't had her, and I'm so glad. But before I had her, I mean, I could have lived the rest of my life and had a lot more time to work, and I wouldn't have known what I was missing. And but I think Miranda, I think the thing about Miranda is, again, she makes her life the perfect working life, but it comes around to bite her in a way, because she has a maternal instinct. As we all know, it's possible to use your maternal instinct in so many ways, by helping in a community or by nurturing young writers, etc. But she lets it get out of hand, I think,
and,
in the book, because she doesn't acknowledge it.
Right. And she is a lonely woman.
Well, yeah, I think most writers do need to be in a space of loneliness in order to get work done.
In the relationship between Roman and Lucy, I hope I'm not giving too much away by saying that they get married.
Yeah, they get married.
And they have a child. And of course, all of us who have experienced motherhood know that there's a difference between motherhood and fatherhood. And it affects people in different ways. But for Roman, he is able to compartmentalize his life. And he has his job as an instructor.
And a poet.
And he is involved with his son's life as well. For Lucy, she allows her motherhood to basically consume her in some ways.
Well, I wouldn't say it consumes her. Let's see if I can figure this out. First of all, I think that being a mother is different from being a father. But just based on my experience with my husband, I feel that being a father is also consuming. I think I'm in a relationship where I'm lucky that my husband is so involved in childcare the way he is. And in many ways, I think he's a better parent than I am. I think that in Roman and Lucy's situation, you've got different characters. Roman is very involved with his writing, and he has, you know, the attic set aside and climbs up there. It's one of those wonderful houses where there's a staircase up to the attic, and the attic is huge. And Lucy's study is on the second floor, and as time goes on, it becomes their child Avery's playroom and her study. And she gets – I think that the problem that Lucy has, and I've thought this through a lot, for one thing, she isn't as persuaded as Roman that writing is the only thing that matters, and she doesn't seek as much worldly success as he does. She doesn't have that bee in her bonnet the way he does.
Which may not be a problem.
No, I don't think it's a problem. I think what makes it a problem only is that she becomes critical of her work. She reads criticism and she takes it too much to heart. And she has that nagging inner voice that combined with a lack – or not lack, but relative lack of ambition, it just makes her shut down a little bit. I mean, I think everybody is born with a different package of traits. And I think that certain traits fuel into productivity and certain ones don't. And that critical voice that sort of shuts down what you write, I think, is the biggest impediment that many writers face. And I think Lucy has it. But I think the other big problem she has is that she's married to Roman, frankly, which, you know, plays out in the book.
It's so funny to listen to you talk about how these characters, you couldn't leave these characters alone. Do you like them?
I do. I like all the characters. I'm very fond of Roman. I mean, people think Roman is quote-unquote unlikable. That's one of the things. It's considered a sin to write a novel with a quote-unquote unlikable character. But the thing is, I never disliked Roman. I'm very sympathetic to Roman. I feel he's driven. You know, he has this drivenness and also deprivation that many writers also have. His childhood is very rough. And so I feel sympathetic to him, and I understand where he's coming from with his desire to make great work. I think his need for external approval is his Achilles heel. And I think his pride and his anger, I think, make it hard for him to stay in close relationships, not just in his marriage, but, you know, with others, as you know, you'll see in the book.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Lan Samantha Chang. Her newest novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, is released today. This is her third book. She's also the director of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. If you have any questions for Samantha Chang, feel free to give us a call. The number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me right now is Lan Samantha Chang. She is the director of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. She's also the author of three books, her first two books, Hunger and Inheritance, and her newest novel, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. It's released today. And just to review, if you just joined us, the beginning of the book takes place in an MFA program where a number of the characters are studying poetry and moves on throughout their lives. And one of the very interesting questions that your characters bring up and your characters debate is about whether or not writing is something that can be taught, which is an interesting question for characters of the director of a writer's workshop to be debating. And another place where I'm sure people will wonder what it means about your thoughts. But why don't we listen to the characters for a little while, and then we can talk about what it means for you.
I'll read from this section where basically Roman finished a manuscript. This is about years. It's more than a decade after they've left their program, graduated, and Bernard is spending some time with Roman and Lucy in the Midwest because he lost his rent control apartment briefly. And Roman tells Bernard about his new manuscript, and he's dying. You know, Bernard reads it, Roman finds out, but Roman's dying to know what Bernard thinks about this manuscript for a number of reasons. So I'll just start. He said to Bernard, "Lucy tells me you read my manuscript." Bernard turned slightly away, troubled. "I didn't mean to keep it from you," he began. Then he pulled his gloves from his pocket. Roman wondered if they had discussed more about the manuscript than Lucy had revealed to him. The heaviness of the lunch, the strength of the coffee, made him wish he had not introduced the subject. "I know," he said. To forestall Bernard's opinion, he thinned and lightened his voice to imitate the question Miranda had asked long ago. "Is this a poem?" Bernard looked at Roman, then at his gloved hands. "It's poetry," he said. Roman waited, and when Bernard did not elaborate, he felt himself on the verge of trying to express the suspicion that had been growing in him over the summer. He had told no one of the feeling, not even Lucy, and he had the sense only just now, and with this listener, of being able to put it into words. "It's not poetry," he said. "It's gnawing on the bones of poetry." Bernard said, winding a narrow red scarf around his neck, "Its insight and breadth is extremely impressive, and the voice is much more convincingly rendered than any work I've seen of yours before." "But you don't like it," Roman asserted. "I didn't say anything like that." "But you don't." They left the warmth of the restaurant reluctantly and set off down the street toward the parking garage. While they were at lunch, the weather had turned suddenly to deep winter, and an icy wind drove them, bringing water to the eyes. Bernard bent his head into the wind. His expression, Roman thought, was strangely aggrieved, or perhaps it was the cold. "It's not quite that, Roman." His voice seemed to echo more loudly outside the restaurant. "Your poems have become in many ways astonishing, really." "But you don't think I've improved much, do you, over the years?" Roman's own voice rang with an uncomfortable clarity against the iron-cold sidewalk. I have an odd opinion about all of this, as you know." "What do you mean?" "To be honest," Bernard said, "I don't think that most of us ever truly improve." They entered the imposing ramp where Roman had parked the car. As they climbed the stairs, Roman felt a dull pulsing behind his temples. He stopped walking for a moment and waited for it to recede. There was something almost menacing in Bernard's words that made it difficult for him to think. "What do you mean by that?" he asked. Bernard spoke slowly and evenly. "I don't think we get better during our lives. Most of us get worse. And the others, well, perhaps they write better books, but they don't, quote, improve. Our truest limitations are not technical. I said it years ago. Poetry cannot be taught. All of this instruction of technique is merely superstition, magical thinking, wishful people tinkering over a decision made for them long ago." "That's not true," Roman said, cutting off the thought with a gesture of his hand. But he himself had often wondered about this question. "Of course it's possible to improve from learning craft," Roman continued lamely. "It's possible to write a better book, perhaps, but not to become a better poet."
Which is an interesting debate that your characters engage in. But what does it mean for you that you allowed your characters to have this debate, to ask this question? And you're talking specifically about poetry, but can...
I meant art. I didn't mean specifically poets. I meant all art. Artists wonder this question.
Can writing be taught?
Yes, I think it can be taught, but everybody who's taught it and everybody who's studied it still has this nagging question. It can be taught up to a point, and then after a point, I have no idea. I mean, I'm supposed to know, obviously. I think that for example, the students that I have in the program are extraordinarily talented. They are so talented that sometimes I feel that if I just got them together and fed them chicken soup, that they would improve in the same way that they currently do. I mean, I feel sometimes as if that I have no control over their artistic development. And I think that when I've read this passage before, teachers have come up to me afterward and said, "You nailed exactly the thing that I wonder about all the time." And students obviously wonder the same thing. And obviously, you know, the entire world wonders, is it possible to teach art? And why are there so many programs in this country where people go to learn about art? And I would say that it's important to support and shelter artists at formative periods in their development, and that one of the things these programs do is to create communities where artists can increase their exposure to the intensity of the artistic endeavor, and that itself will help them improve. In addition to that, I do think that, especially as a fiction writer, and I don't want to speak for, you know, the creation of poetry since I don't write it, but I think that there are craft issues that people learn at these programs that will help them. But everybody knows craft can only bring you so far.
I interviewed a novelist a couple of years ago who had written his first novel at the age of 40. And he was talking, and he'd written many other nonfiction books throughout his life, but this was his first novel. And he said that, you know, in thinking about novelists who try to write novels or do write novels in their early 20s, he said, I don't know what they can write about. He said they haven't had these life experiences. Is that what you're talking about? Because
no.
Okay.
I mean, I feel that I've seen some amazing work come from people in their early 20s. So I've also seen amazing work come from people in their 40s. No, I guess what I'm just talking about is that there's a kind of pressure people put on the words from an internal pressure that comes out on the page. I mean, you can tell when somebody has a strong voice, and you can't give it to them. You can try. You can teach them sentence construction and vocabulary and talk about diction, and you can talk about writing about what you know and care about. But some people write with a force that can't be denied, and it's extraordinarily difficult to, as a teacher, to turn that force on and off. I would say that most people probably have a button that if you push it, they would be able to write more convincingly than they ever have. The question is, where is it? Many times people live their whole lives without knowing where it is.
In the book, Roman goes through life experiences that in the beginning of the book, his teacher Miranda's comment about his poetry is that
you write as if you have no soul.
Right, exactly. And but through the book, obviously he goes through many things, and he has his heart broken, and things happen to him that perhaps one interpretation would be that he's able to reach deeper and express his soul through his book. Now, that is debatable.
I think it is debatable in his case. I think every writer has a blind spot. And I think Roman's blind spot is something that he only gradually becomes aware of, even though everyone keeps trying to explain to him what it is.
When people read this and they read that question, and of course, you know, you said that other teachers hear that question and say you've nailed it. But what about people who are students of writing? What do you think they can and should take away from that question?
I think that they need to know that the source of a person's power to make things is internal. It's essentially internal. And that to seek validation from the outside, whether that be in a classroom or from one's peers, is not going to help. And so if your teacher says something to you, that if they give you a piece of advice about your work, you can feel free to take it or leave it. I mean, ultimately, there is no way, there is no surefire way to find your power. I think that it's pretty clear from the book also, though, that the students study in the program and that they're all gifted, and the ones that the factors that keep them from achieving what they want to achieve are often related more to their life situation and to their personality than it has to do with their level of talent, their inherent gifts. And I think that many people who struggle to write, for example, don't have enough time, and that can put a huge kibosh, as they say, on the work. And you can be extremely gifted, and if you don't have the time, if your life is set up so that you don't have time, you're struggling against a pretty large boulder.
Is that what you think an MFA program really does for people? Gives them that gift of time?
I think MFA programs give people a gift of time, and the best programs give people a strong community. One of the reasons I think that the Iowa Writers Workshop is so strong and has been strong for so long has to do with this community that we all live in here in Iowa City. It's I think, a laid-back community. It's a supportive community. It's a literate, you know, a very involved and passionate community. We have Prairie Lights Bookstore, the most amazing bookstore. We have many, many readers in this area and in the whole state of Iowa. And it seems to me that that is one of the reasons that the program has maintained its strength over the years, that there's a wonderful location and it's far enough away from the distraction of big cities. And that is one of those external constraints. Anyway, it forces students to really look at their work. I think the faculty and our program is unparalleled. And moreover, I think that the students create a community and they become their own literary generation. and they move forward. I always tell my students, look, we, your teachers, are going to die, but you and your friends are going to become your own generation of writers. And so it's very, very important to just be part of your class and listen to what your peers have to say.
In your book, all of your characters who dedicate their lives to writing pay a price for that. Is that a struggle that you see a lot, that a dedication to writing exacts a price from people who make that commitment?
Honestly, I think a dedication to any pursuit exacts a price. Anything that we care about is going to hurt us. And I think that's the big struggle in life, is to care. And one of the things that the poets in this book, I think, excel at is caring. And as a result, I hold them up in my mind as people that I admire. Any kind of commitment involves a loss or a choice. I think that is true whether you're writing poetry or participating in local government.
With writing, I think, because it's not visible unless you achieve some level of success, does that make the struggle more difficult? Because I remember the old saying, I wrote a novel and my friend said, and I told them that I was getting it published and they were so excited. But the act, the actual achievement was the writing. Does that make it more difficult that the thing that you sweat blood over is almost invisible to people?
I think that most writers come to terms at some point with the fact that the pleasure that they receive, the rewards of writing, come when you're actually writing. That if you seek rewards outside of the writing, there's a kind of disappointment, but also it can lead to shutting off of the very act that is so necessary. I think that most people who continue to write learn to take a great pleasure in the process.
Has writing changed for you as your life has changed? You have a very fulfilling job and career. You are a mother of a young child. Is writing different for you now?
Wait one sec. What I said, pleasure in the process, I don't really think it's pleasure. It's more like a kind of satisfaction out of having tried. So I don't mean to say that people go to their desks every morning whistling.
Right.
Having a very busy life right now is fascinating to me. And I assume that at some point I will be able to write about what that's like. And, having the opportunity to be so involved with young writers is a real privilege. And I feel, I don't know, that I'm in a wonderful spot right now. In terms of my writing, I have managed to write this book. And to me, that's a huge hopeful sign. So I look forward to continuing at this point.
And if you ever continue your other project, the three novella project, you're going to have to find a new title for it.
Yeah.
is it still there on the back burner?
I don't feel like writing that right now. Yeah. I'm going to let it sit for a while.
All right. Well, Samantha Chang, thank you so much for your time. And I think it's going to be an interesting ride as you as this novel is read and
definitely.
People ask you a lot of questions. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Lan Samantha Chang is the author of, most recently, All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost, a novel that comes out today. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on the 30th of September at 7 p.m. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And you can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow, the inspiring stories of four football legends.
This is Pat Blank. Each weekday afternoon beginning at 4, I host the local component of NPR's All Things Considered here on Iowa Public Radio.